Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I want to look at an aspect of Nazism and a figure within the inner workings of the Nazi regime, at least during the 1930s, that gets to some extent overlooked, and that is the Treasury Minister Hjalmar Schacht, Dr. Hjalmar Schacht, who was on the 16th of March 1933. Appointed to the presidency of the Reichsbank by Adolf Hitler. Now, as we've explored before, Hitler has very little understanding of economics and comparatively little interest in it. For him, economics was a simple matter of racial conquest. The way that you grow your economy is by plundering the economies of lesser peoples. Hitler's main goal when he took office in January 1933 was the March election. On this, everything hung. Economic policy was spoken about in broad generalizations. He made a kind of a broad commitment in his speech, the appeal to the nation, to solve unemployment and the poverty of the kind of agrarian class. He didn't make any detailed specific proposals like any good fascist populist figure who was seeking to speak to anyone who would listen. He had a vague understanding that in order to allot resources to one portion of society, you need to drain them away from another. And so going into specifics in terms of economic policy pledges was not what he wished to do. On the 8th of February, Hitler told his cabinet they should avoid all detailed statements concerning the economic programme of the government. So Hitler was hoping to have the widest possible appeal to secure the largest section of the population, and didn't want to be unpopular in any way. Now, in Hitler's agenda to prepare Germany for war, he needed the broadest mandate possible to transform society, to create this sort of people's community, the Volksgemeinschaft, and he needed to be able to have as broad a mandate possible and to introduce the kind of extreme measures that he wanted to see, particularly the cutting away of what was referred to as social ballast, those kind of unproductive individuals, be they the people with disabilities or those who are asocial. This is even before he's considering racial policy against the Jews. So, as you can imagine, the complexities of fiscal and monetary policy Hitler is not engaging with at all. So when on the 16th of March the presidency of the Reichsbank is handed to Hjalmar Schacht, it's quite a momentous decision for a number of reasons. Schacht's predecessor had been Hans Luther, who had been a highly conservative figure who had restricted the Weimar government's from spending. So he had not been very keen on work creation programs. He'd not been very keen on notionally Keynesian ideas because he thought they were inflationary, and indeed they generally tend to be. If you pump money into an economy without sort of growing the productive base of the economy, you have lots and lots of money chasing the same amount of resources, and therefore you have bidding for those resources and prices begin to outstrip wages. However, The figure of Luther, who was disposed of and was replaced by Schacht, who had a significant part to play in the economic history of the Weimar Republic. In the 1920s, Schacht had been in charge of the Young Plan and had been part of the nationalist opposition to the Republic. So in 1931 he had created links with Hitler and had continued to support Hitler even when it looked as if Hitler's time in the wilderness might be indefinite. Schacht himself wasn't in the Nazi Party at this point. The Nazi Party had all sorts of fellow travellers on the right, people who perhaps didn't subscribe necessarily to the virulent anti-Semitism of the Nazis, but had their own bigotries and prejudices and had kind of degrees of anti-Semitism. Schacht himself, his skill was that he was able to create financial instruments to make the kind of the economic impossible seem possible. The financial smoke and mirrors that have become an increasing feature of 20th century economic history. And he was able now to bring these skills to Nazism, to the Nazi regime, and try to introduce the sorts of measures that he thought would stabilise Germany. And these measures, as we'll see, perhaps, hopefully in this podcast, but certainly in subsequent podcasts on Hjalmar Schacht, these measures would eventually actually bring him into conflict with Hitler. When Schacht began to develop deficit financing, so creating debt in order to pay for essential infrastructure or rearmament, these were practices that Schacht's predecessors had been very, very anxious about and were determined to avoid. The hyperinflation of 1923 had been a kind of a salutary lesson to the Weimar Republic. One of the most significant innovations was the creation of the MIFO bill. And the method worked something like this. The MIFO bill was a device for creating money, creating cash flow in order to pay for rearmament. In Noakes and Pridham's Nazism, a Documentary Reader, they quote the financier, the Emil Puhl, who was the post-war director of the Reichsbank, and when he explained MIFO bills. Emil Puhl said, "Dr. Schacht, president of the Reichsbank, after considering various techniques of financing, proposed the use of the MIFO bill to provide a substantial portion of the funds needed for the rearmament programme. This method has had as one of its primary advantages the fact that secrecy would be possible during the first years of the rearmament programme, and figures indicating the extent of rearmament would have become public through the use of other methods, and they could be kept secret through the use of MIFO bills. MIFO bills, abbreviated for MIFO Vesel, were drawn by the armament contractor and then accepted by the Metallurgische Forschungsgesellschaft, which was abbreviated to MIFO. These bills ran for 6 months, with extensions running for 3 months each consecutively. The total life of the bills varied, and in some instances exceeded for 4 years. The Reichsbank could discount the original bill any time within its last 3 months. The co-endorser and drawer did not have to accept any liability. This provision results from the guarantee of the bill by the Reich. The MIFO bills were used exclusively for financing rearmament, and when in March 1938 a new finance programme discontinuing the use of MIFO bills was announced by Dr. Schacht, there was a total volume outstanding of 12 billion marks of MIFO bills, which had been issued to finance rearmament. One of the primary reasons for discontinuing financing rearmament with MIFO bills was that by the spring of 1938 it was no longer considered necessary to keep the progress of German rearmament secret. The rearmament boom had then reached such proportions as it became possible by taxation and by the sale of government securities to raise the sums which could never have been raised when the rearmament program acceleration began in 1935. So, in plain speaking, the MIFO bill, as it stresses there, was a way of keeping rearmament secret because the Metallurgische Forschungsgesellschaft, innocuous sounding metallurgical enterprise, was ultimately a kind of like a finance house for rearmament. Any weapons inspectors or foreign observers making sure that Germany was adhering to the Treaty of Versailles would look at MIFO bills and believe that they were there to finance something entirely different, something civilian and industrial. The second point of is that the MIFO bill is essentially a bond. It is a kind of a promise to the future. The issuer says that it is worth a certain amount, it can be spent on arms, and it is guaranteed by the German government. The German government will pay either in 6 months' time, which could be extended by 3 months, but in some cases it ran to over 4 years, and it was an assumption. There was an assumption underlying all of this that the German economy would have grown sufficiently at that point for taxation to repay the capital and the interest on the bill. So this was really the regime creating for itself some kind of imaginary line of credit in order to rearm and in order to conceal this as well. Between 1934 and 1936, the MIFO bills accounted for half of all arms spending. After that, when the economy recovered, rearmament began to shift to from MIFO bills to taxation, and the need for secrecy had dissipated at that point because Germany's rearmament was known to everybody, and the regime had no interest in hiding or concealing what it was doing. Now, I've said before that Hitler's lack of understanding about economic issues meant that the Nazi economy never fully resolved any of the crises that it faced. Instead, as so often happens, the crisis sort of transforms itself or transmutes itself and reemerges later down the line. So, between 1933 and 1934, rearmament was threatened by two significant crises, foreign debt and the balance of payments. And the issue of foreign debt was significant. Hitler's government was in a good position, a better position than any of its predecessors in terms of reparations, as the Weimar government, particularly Heinrich Brüning's government, had done an awful lot to reduce reparations, and by 1932 at the Lausanne Conference, reparations are actually cancelled. But there was still significant debt that Germany owed for having taken out loans to repay reparations. So that persisted. And Hitler had a great deal of political capital from the German people.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
To walk away from Germany's financial liabilities if he so chose. A large number of other more mundane and mainstream commercial debts were outstanding. Now we go back to Poole again, who now describes Schacht's views on Germany's foreign debt. And he says, after Hitler came to power, and after Schacht returned to the presidency of the Reichsbank, the problem of Germany's long-term and medium-term indebtedness was met by the declaration of a transfer moratorium. By law, starting on the 1st of July 1933, German debtors were compelled to make payments in Reichsmarks instead of the foreign currency in which the debt might have been incurred, normally, for example, US dollars. The law was not applicable to debts for which standstill agreements had been concluded, the Dawes loans, the Young loans, or other foreign loans for which special arrangements were made. It was left to the discretion of the Reichsbank to determine when, if ever, transfer into foreign currency should be made from the funds of the conversion CAS, which was the conversion fund for foreign debt. Immediate threats of retaliatory measures by foreign countries brought a partial payment of interest charges in foreign exchange and in scrip, which were told which were sold at a substantial discount. However, after the 1st of July 1934, a complete transfer moratorium was put into effect, and no more foreign exchange transfers for payment of interest took place, as funding bonds were offered to foreign creditors as payment. So government bond was offered in Reichsmarks instead of conversion of the Reichsmark into US dollars or pound sterling or what have you. And this was a way of hanging on, obviously, to foreign currency reserves, which are immensely of strategic and economic value, particularly if, as Hitler was doing, considering waging a war in the future. Now, it goes without saying that there was considerable anger from Germany's creditors. It might have been possible to have altered this policy had the creditors taken a united stand, and Germany might have been forced, for example, to divert foreign exchange from paying for raw materials, for rearmament towards paying off debts, and so it would have had a significant impact on Germany's developing war machine. However, During the 1930s, one of the most exacerbating factors of the Great Depression and one of the most significant impacts of the Great Depression was the decline in economic cooperation. The rise in protectionism, for example, between Europe and America resulted also in a lack of joined up economic policy and kind of economic security policy to deal with rogue states like Germany. The other major problem, as just mentioned, was Germany's balance of payments issue. Germany has a outflow of currency from itself to creditor nations and to other trading nations who have more attractive goods and services than Germany at the time. During 1933, there was a favourable balance of 667 million Reichsmarks, but the decline in food imports was really partly as a result of this. In 1933, the press baron Alfred Hugenberg, who became one of Hitler's ministers, had introduced protectionism into Germany's kind of food economy, and this resulted in this balance of payments surplus. However, the following year, in 1934, the balance of payments dipped to a negative of 284 million Reichsmarks. Now, for those who aren't economists, the balance of payments really is a measure of trade. It is a measure of how much trade one is doing with the outside world and how successfully the outside world is exporting its goods and services to your country. So a negative balance of payments indicates an outflow of cash from your country to other countries in order to pay for imports, and it also indicates that your domestic industries aren't really competing very well with your domestic home market and they prefer goods and services from other countries. So it's not a good look. This balance of payments was a result of two things. Firstly, the programs of rearmament and work creation involved lots and lots of raw materials which had to be imported. And this increases consumer demand. Rearmament increases consumer demand because money is pouring into people's pockets. Because your consumer demand is going up and the raw materials in Germany are being consumed by rearmament, there are lots of nice, attractive things in the shops to buy with the new cash burning holes in people's pockets, and so they look to products from overseas. Unlike Britain, who devalued the pound, took it off the gold standard, allowed it to decrease in value, and thus it really ended the Great Depression by about 1934, Germany desperately hung on to a highly valued Reichsmark, partly for kind of reasons of misguided national prestige. But this led to German exports being too expensive. And as a result, the economic crisis that Germany faced kind of limped on. And it also meant that the balance of payments problem was largely unresolvable. In June 1934, gold and foreign exchange reserves in the Reichsbank had fallen so low that they had reached a level of 100 million Reichsmarks, which is next to nothing, really. And the government was in a serious danger of losing all foreign currency reserves altogether. This meant that foreign exchange controls had to be introduced. They'd originally been brought about in August 1931, but the 25th of June it was decided that the Reichsbank would allocate foreign exchange on a day-to-day basis. So if an importer wanted to buy a large amount of French wine or American cars and needed to have to access a large amount of dollars in order to do it. These dollars would be, these foreign exchange reserves would be rationed, and it would be down to the scrutiny on the kind of the judgment of Schacht and his ministry and the Reichsbank as to whether this kind of currency would be handed out for these sorts of transactions. And so imports and exports become politicized, and the obvious point that would be made by Reichsbank officials is why can't your business either produce a local alternative to the thing you're importing, or why can't you find somebody else in Germany that makes this thing that you're importing? There were, of course, a list of priority items that needed to be imported, raw materials and the kinds of things that would only be useful to rearmament were imported. There was a moment where it looked as if the rearmament program would be threatened, but the intervention of the armed forces was there to make sure that rearmament went ahead just as it should do. And here we see an interesting clash. Economics Minister Kurt Schmidt had a very kind of Keynesian approach to dealing with unemployment and low consumption. He thought if you grew the purchasing power of the masses, obviously by putting money in their pockets, you would increase employment, and that would mean that unemployment payments would decline. And this would, in the view of the army, be a nightmare, because increased consumer spending would mean that resources would be steered away from the rearmaments industry, or it would mean a flow of imports and the foreign exchange problem would exacerbate itself. So in some of the generals of the Wehrmacht thought, it is better that the German people learn about hardship and privation, because they'll need to be a lot tougher with a lot fewer luxuries for the forthcoming struggle of national survival and the rerun of the First World War, which the Wehrmacht and Hitler were both rather keen on initiating. And the army, by Colonel Georg Thomas, who was the head of the Defence Economy and Weapons Bureau, the Wehrwissenschaft und Waffenwissen, which was part of the Wehrmacht office. He wrote to Hitler on the 20th of June 1934 and said the following things. The Reich Defence Ministry has for years been pointing out the necessity of preparing the economy for the event of war. It has demanded stockpiling and revealed the dangers of the loss of foreign exchange and the collapse of exports for the defence of the country, and has especially requested the regulation of the peacetime economy in accordance with the needs of war. Only the present Reich government has decided to fulfil these demands, but unfortunately economic developments threaten to nullify these efforts, which have hardly begun. The information from industry and reports from the supervisory officials for raw materials show clearly that the raw material situation is becoming daily more acute. Not only does this endanger the government's work programme, but also the basis for an operational commitment of the Wehrmacht is becoming more and more remote, and everywhere the question is being asked, what is the point of a larger army if it lacks supplies, its lifeblood? The raw material situation is taken far more seriously by the business community than the Reich Economic Ministry, and since everybody is clear about the fact that we are in the middle of an economic war, it is incomprehensible that decisions are not taken to overcome the danger which threatens. For months we have noticed the drain of foreign exchange followed by the melting away of stocks of raw materials, but so far there has been no firm intervention to remove the danger, with a few exceptions which have proved insufficient. What has happened to all the lessons we have learned from the Great War in the economic field? Because of the struggles between capitalist interest groups, the wishes of the party officers, and the misguided interventions and opinions of individuals, no decisions are taken. So this was a kind of an appeal to Hitler to act, to intervene, and to make a decision. And we will see in a forthcoming podcast on Hjalmar Schacht and Hitler, I'll probably do in a week or so, what his actions were. Anyway, I hope you found this useful, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Do swing by our Facebook page, and there's a link to the new Facebook group at the bottom of this podcast. All the best, thanks, bye-bye.